What the heck is that?
It's Belgian chant music. It's the Belgian show.
And why are you wearing my bathrobe?
Because I'm acting like I'm a Belgian. I'm interviewing Mr. Randy Thiel from the brewery Ama Gang. So I wanted to wear a bathrobe because I don't have a monk's robe. Tell you what, while you're getting some good blues music ready for the end of this show, why don't you sit there on eBay and find me a monk's robe, and I'm going to buy it and I'm going to wear it every single time I brew.
Well, you certainly don't look like a monk wearing a blue fuzzy bathrobe with moons and stars all over it.
Well, use your imagination. All right, ladies and gentlemen and fellow homebrewers, this show is Ale About Beer, but tonight it's Ale About Ama Gang. I have on the line on my very cell phone, finally, I've got it all wired up, hooked up, ready to go, I think, but I have on the line Mr. Randy Thiel, the master brewer of Ama Gang. So how are you doing tonight, Mr. Randy?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Lonnie?
Very good, and I'm so glad you took the time out. You probably had a busy brewing day. I'm assuming you're at home now with a beer in front of you. So
you know, actually, I don't have a beer in front of me just yet, but I will very soon.
Yeah, well, I can tell you I don't have an Ama Gang. I probably put about 500 miles on my truck going around Houston trying to find it. And yeah, I had one about 2 years ago. We have a Specs warehouse down here, and I finally found some Ama Gang. I think it was Hennepin ale, and I had some of that, but they stopped carrying it, and I'm assured by a friend of mine at Specs, finally, they're going to have it on Valentine's, but they don't know what's coming in. They're thinking Three Philosophers. Now, that would just blow my mind. I haven't had one yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's being sent down there, but yeah, the big news is that Brewery Ama Gang's beers are being sent back into Texas, and we're pretty excited about that.
Well, I could tell you we are, too. Like I said, it was about 2 years ago since I've even seen it, and it's just kind of hard to get down here. Before we get too further, I introduced you, but nobody knows who you are.
Well, my name is Randy Thiel. I'm the brewmaster at Brewery Ama Gang, which is a small microbrewery in upstate New York, in Cooperstown, New York, also known as the home of the Baseball Hall of Fame. They're a little bit more well-known than we are.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a nice arrangement. A lot of people come into Cooperstown to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame, which, by the way, is a fabulous museum. And I don't even like baseball, but I've been there several times, and it's a great museum. But anyway, people come to Cooperstown to go to the Hall of Fame, and we're literally in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, when they make the long journey to the Hall of Fame, they're looking for something else to do in the area. And lo and behold, there's a nice, beautiful microbrewery down the road that you can visit. And, you know, having that type of visitor at the brewery is the best because they don't necessarily have any preconceived notions about what Belgian beer is about. And they come there, and for the most part, you know, a lot of people visit, they say they don't even like beer. And then they try our beer and they realize that, you know, oh my God, I didn't know beer could be like this. So almost every day we see someone that has that wonderful epiphany of discovering Belgian style beers.
Well, that sounds like when I discovered Belgian beers. It wasn't in Cooperstown, unfortunately, but I talked to you a couple of weeks ago on the phone, and you know my whole Cooperstown story. I'm going to go ahead and refrain from saying that during our interview. I'll tell the listeners a little bit later about my Cooperstown, sad Cooperstown story. As you know, I lived there for a little while. To sum it up, I could be working for you. So,
what years did you live here?
It was right before you opened. It was like 95, 96. I lived there for a couple of years, 2 years and a half or so, stumbling around for work, and there wasn't much to do. And lo and behold, I find myself in San Francisco. I moved, and then you opened up, I find, just a few months after I left. And, you know, I could have been a brewer, I guess. So,
you know, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, you know, that's we're going to get into that a little bit. That's a home brewer's dream, but then I also hear it's a home brewer's nightmare. But
it can be, yeah. It's a tough living.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And speaking of that, have you home brewed?
Oh yeah, actually, that's how I got into what I do. I actually started out. I went to college, and I grew up in Wisconsin. Went to college at UW-Madison. Got a degree in microbiology and worked in a medical lab for about 7 years. And during that time, I started homebrewing, and it quickly became a hobby that I became a little too obsessed about, and I thought I'd better make a career choice out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went to, I took a short course at the Siebel Institute in mm-hmm. Chicago, and then followed that up with the Brewmaster's program at UC Davis.
Okay, I didn't know that tidbit. You know, I told you earlier on the phone today, I've been kind of studying you, stalking you a little bit on the internet there. So
I could sense it.
Yeah, I knew you went to Siebel there, but I didn't know you went to Davis also. So you've had quite a career. You've been with Brewery Omegang, or Omegang. There's my Texas slur. Hey, we say a lot of weird things. Like I say, I have my own dictionary down here. So, but how long have you been with Omegang?
Since the very beginning. I actually heard about Omegang opening up when I was still out at UC Davis in 1997. And it sounded like the exact type of brewery I wanted to be involved with. So, you know, a startup microbrewery that really was taking an artisanal approach to brewing beers. And even at that time, I really wasn't familiar with many Belgian-style beers. But as soon as I was done with UC Davis, I drove across the country in my little red rust bucket of a car and interviewed for the assistant brewmaster position. And I got it on the spot. And so I got, you know, came out of brewing school and landed a good job. And there was a Belgian brewmaster here at that time, and they were still installing equipment. And I came in to help out with the quality control program and help do the whole startup phase. And fortunate for me, it was just, you know, good timing. The brewmaster got homesick and missed his girlfriend back in Belgium. So he boogied back to Belgium, and I got his job.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so very good timing on my part.
Well, you've had a good career. I see in my stalkings last night, I also discovered something I didn't know, that you had been inducted to the Belgian Brewers Guild, or the Knighthood of Belgian Brewers. I read some little piece, and I hope it's true. You know the internet, you got to be careful, but that looked like a pretty official indoctrination to me. So could you say a little bit about how that felt and what that even means to us?
Well, that happened a few years ago, and, you know, Belgium, you'll hear people say that Belgium is, you know, is beer heaven, and it's true. It's a small country. You can drive across it in 3 hours, no problem, but it has over 100 different breweries in it, and you know, you figure each of those breweries makes about 5 different beers on average. So they have 500 different beers in a very small country. So, you know, that's a long way of saying that it's a very beer-proud nation. And they have a long history in brewing as a commercial center in Europe. Since the medieval times, the country was not so much ruled by a monarchy as it was ruled by what they call the guild houses. So there's various guilds, like textile guilds, brewing guilds, chocolate guilds, lace-making guilds, you know, the butcher guilds, the grain guilds. And these, basically, they were like commercial unions that mm-hmm. controlled a lot of the commerce and therefore controlled much of that territory. And so they really had the power. And so the Belgian Brewers Guild has been around for centuries. And it's survived, and you know, nowadays it's not so much an entity for commercial control as it is just a brewer's association. So, but it does have a long, proud history. So back in 2004, I received a letter from the Belgian Brewers Guild, and they wanted to induct me into the a portion of the guild that was the name for it is the Chevalry des Forquets de Brasseurs, which means the Knights of the Mash Fork, because they felt that I was doing a lot to promote Belgian-style beer and Belgian beer and Belgian culture in America, and they just wanted to show appreciation for that. So I was I still am the first and the only American brewer that's been inducted into that guild.
Well, that's exactly what that article started out with, so I was real curious about that. It said you were the only one, so that's usually pretty prestigious to get something like that. It's true, though, in Belgium, and this is just what I grew up. I'm a Belgian fanatic. On my earlier shows, I talked about being a Belgian beer fanatic, and I want to wear a dress and all that and brew in silence total for the rest of my life. But But one of the things that intrigued me about the Belgian mentality in general was about their style, and they don't care much about style. They brew the beer they brew, and if you don't like it, you can go down the road and get somebody else's beer. Yeah. Is that really true? Or?
Yeah, I'd say for the most part that's true. I think, you know, in America, especially us devout beer geeks, you know, we grew up with, you know, home brewing, and that was because of that interest. We really wanted to know more about different beers from around the world. So we became, you know, like it or not, we became very style oriented, just as a way to discuss and talk about all the different beers that were coming from around the world.
Right.
Whereas in Belgium, when you try to describe their attitude towards beer, you kind of describe their attitude towards life. And that is they're very individualistic. They're very understated people. They don't like to pigeonhole things. And when it comes to brewing, they just like to produce very unique beers that are an expression of what they're all about. And for the most part, they don't really do any of the copycat type of brewing.
Like I do.
Well, you know, like we all do.
Right.
And, you know, when Sierra Nevada first came on the scene and started becoming popular, you know, everybody wanted to start brewing a pale ale that was similar to Sierra Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine because that's a great beer.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of it's kind of an American way of doing things. We tend to imitate others, and then it starts becoming something else. And a good example of that is American versions of pizza. You know, what we have for pizza in this country is not like the way pizza was intended to be in Italy. We just took it and we morphed it into something else, and lo and behold, you know, we have Chicago-style pizza, New York flat-style pizza, and all these, you know, California gourmet-type pizzas.
Right.
And that's that's the nature of the American beast. We take something, we get obsessed with it, and we take it and mold it and turn it into something different, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the Belgians, they tend to be a little more reserved and quiet and not so gung-ho about anything in particular.
Yeah. Well, that is our way. I mean, that's how I brew, and I'm sure you've done it in homebrew too. You try. I guess it's a natural evolution to get bigger and better. It seems that way, and I guess all the competitions, probably including the GABF, that everybody's trying to push the limits, and every year they push a little bit more. Styles change a little bit. Tastes change a little bit, and we're always trying to push the limits up there. And that's what I wanted to ask you. I wanted to get into your a couple of beers you had. I already expressed I have never tried the Three Philosophers. I haven't had the opportunity to get that. And also, I know you have this Omageddon that I've read about, and I'm really interested in that. Is that the one you use your homegrown hops in for the festival, or is there another? I know you have a festival every year, and you grow your own homegrown hops for that beer.
Well, we have several festivals at Brewery Omageddon throughout the year. And, you know, obviously we don't have festivals this time of year just because it's so ungodly, bitterly cold up here.
Right. 2 feet.
Yeah, we don't have much snow right now. Yeah. And, but it's nasty cold out. That's why I missed your phone call before. Mm-hmm. It took me about an hour to get home. So.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. I remember the days, the 2 years I was there, it was like 20 feet. Deep,
oh, no,
I think, was the
air.
Well, I'm making that up, but I mean, it was like snow 6 months out of the year.
Yeah, I swear. For one of our summer festivals, actually, it's in the fall. It's a harvest type festival, and this whole area used to be the center of hop growing in America.
Right.
And in fact, the brewery Omageddon is situated on 150 acres out in the countryside. And mm-hmm. that used to be the location of the biggest hop farm in Otsego County.
Exactly. I know that much. I lived on our very property. I lived on my, I might as well say it, Moonbeam, my wife will hear this. She already knows my first wife's family had a hops house on there, right there in Fly Creek where I lived, in Fly Creek, right outside of Cooperstown. And we had a hops barn, and I just stayed in there. You know, I can imagine the hops hanging many, many years ago in that barn. So I know exactly where you're located. That's what fascinates me about that, because it was very enriched with beer, I think, at that time, at least growing hops.
Yeah. In fact, you can drive around the countryside and you can come across these old barns that, you know, are, have a kind of peculiar shape to them. They have like a pyramid roof on one side and an A-frame roof on the other side. And
right.
That's where they collected the hops and dried them and baled them up.
Yep. Well, I remember sitting in there and seeing every bit of that, wishing they were still full of hops too. So, and I wasn't even a brewer back then. So who knows? Maybe I would have become one if I was there when y'all opened up. But yeah. I'm all into it now, and we're all about homebrew. So, yeah. But more about Omageddon. Excuse me. That's not a beer that you can buy in a bottle. I don't think. Is it?
At the moment, no, but it will be at some point this year, definitely by summertime. We haven't released a new beer in quite a while, just because the demand for our other five beers is so great that we can't afford, you know, extra tank space to make the beer. Not that we can't afford it; it's, we just don't have space for extra tanks right now.
Right. That's something else that I'd like to get into is your fermentation. I'd already told you that on the phone. A little bit. I'm fascinated with a Belgian fermentation profile, but maybe I've got this wrong. I've learned over the years that the Belgian beers, they use a different profile of ferment, a little bit shallower than our steep, I guess about 60-degree American conical fermenters. But then I learned that you open ferment, and that blew my whole theory away. So, because that's like the real old days.
The fermentation vessel design, I wouldn't say that Belgians use a particular fermentation vessel. Brewers being brewers, they'll use whatever they can to put the wort into and get it fermenting. So a lot of people end up using whatever is at their disposal. And so there are some that have like some shallow open fermentation vessels. We have one like that too. But we also use, rather large closed cylindrical conical tanks.
Right, more of the American style.
Yeah, yeah, and even in Europe and Belgium, you see more and more breweries using these. They're just they're a very good way to ferment beer, and not to get into too much technical detail.
Oh, we're technical here now. You're a home brewer, man. We're all about technical. So
yeah, the old way of brewing in Germany and even in America was that you'd ferment in one tank, and then when it was all fermented, you transferred it to a lagering tank.
Right.
And now we have these, vertical cylinder conical tanks that have basically they're a vertical silo cylinder. And then on the bottom they have a cone.
Right.
And they also call these unitanks because you can ferment in them and lager in them also. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of that is that you're not transferring the beer, which beats up the beer. It can expose the beer to oxygen, and you end up also losing beer whenever you transfer it.
Right. So, exactly.
It's a great design, great simple design for a fermentation tank.
Yeah. Well, I also learned on the big WWW, and it's fascinating what you can read at a mouse click, but I guess it's true that you open ferment, and then you also, part of your beer is fermented in open tanks, then you ferment it into conicals, and then you blend back the two? Is that too proprietary? Yeah. Or
actually, the there's two reasons that we have a open fermentation. One is that we do get a lot of visitors to the brewery, and the visitors come, we give them a tour, and we want to take this captive audience and really let them know about how beer is made, and let them know about Belgian style beer in particular. And the one practical advantage of the open fermentation tank in this respect is that it serves as eye candy for tourists.
Well, that's true.
Which is actually very important. I don't mean to like denigrate it.
But it really is. I can see that. I would just drop on my knees and bow down if I walked into that room.
Yeah. You go to other breweries that have closed tanks, and the tour guide will tell you, in this tank, the beer is fermenting. And that doesn't mean anything to anybody that doesn't know how beer is made.
Right.
Like, it's fermenting. But when you can actually see it fermenting, and you see that yeast head, you see that foam on top of the beer.
And smell it.
And you can smell it. It's just like, they have an epiphany that, oh my God, this is a living, breathing process, and you can't rush making beer. I think a lot of people think that beer is just, fizzy water, some alcohol, and some beer flavor extract put together and put in a can. And it's not. It's a very honored tradition of making a beverage that, you know, utilizing nature, and it's a living process.
Exactly.
It takes time, and, you know, just like wine.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that is really the premise behind most every home brewer, including myself, I've talked to. It's the process that, to me, that's what it's all about. Really, it's something to think about.
The second practical aspect of the open fermenter is that because we're making really strong beers at Brewery Almagang, the open fermenter allows us a way to harvest the yeast from the top of the beer and reuse it for the next fermentations or for bottle conditioning. Now, most other breweries that have closed vessels, what they do is they have to wait for the beer to fully ferment at a warmer temperature, and then they crash cool it, and the yeast drops to the bottom of the tank in the cone, and then they cone harvest it. Now, if you're doing that with a very strong beer, the yeast will be all beat up, and it'll be in very poor physical condition when you want to reuse it. So with the open fermenter, we basically rescue the yeast before it gets beat up by falling back in the beer.
By top cropping?
Yeah, top cropping.
Yeah. I know that the big debate in homebrew, as you well know, is the difference between rock candy sugar. Man, I used to be very adamant about that, versus using table sugar in your beers versus candy syrup, which is now available. And I've tried that in a couple beers, and I think that's about my favorite. And I'm just wondering what you can say about adding sugars to your beers to, A, thin out the body, and it's a lot more fermentable, 100% fermentable. And what's your thoughts on sugars in Belgian beers?
Well, I guess first to state the purpose of adding sugar to the brew house process is to achieve a higher original gravity, which will in turn make a stronger beer. Now, you could do that by just using more malt and achieve a higher original gravity. But what happens is that the wort that's produced, you know, when you think about wort, what is it? It's a complex mixture of different types of sugars. There's glucose, there's fructose, there's sucrose, there's maltotriose, there's maltose, and also there's a lot of other carbohydrate-type compounds that are unfermentable. And there's proteins and yada-da-yada-da. But when you ferment that wort, there's a lot of stuff left behind that can make the beer more viscous in nature, or at least have a perceived thickness to it. And when you try to boost the gravity by adding a pure sugar, be it rock candy or table sugar or corn sugar or high fructose corn syrup, what you're doing is adding this very simple sugar that the yeast can consume completely, and there won't be any residual extract left over. So you make a stronger beer that has a lighter body. And that's very key to the Belgian way of brewing, is that what they like to refer to it as is making a beer digestible. That is, it's very light on the palate. And if it's light on the palate, it's going to be easy on the stomach, so you don't feel, you know, bloated, or you don't feel like you have a big starch ball in your stomach after you drink a beer. So that's very important in that respect. Now, does it matter which simple sugar you use? In general, no, it doesn't matter. You can use table sugar, which is sucrose. You can use dextrose, or also known as corn sugar. One form of dextrose is derived from corn.
Yes.
And you can use Belgian candy sugar, which is like rock candy, which is simply crystallized sucrose.
Yeah, and hard to melt.
And in essence, since it's being metabolized or eaten up completely by the yeast, it doesn't really matter what it is. It doesn't have a huge effect on the flavor of the beer.
Yeah, it's the end product, I guess.
Right. And there's some people that say, well, if you add a lot of glucose, also known as dextrose, you can induce inhibitory metabolism in the yeast called the Crabtree effect. And that doesn't really apply to brewery fermentations. It does apply to when you're trying to propagate yeast. Like, let's say you're Fleischmann's and you're trying to grow a bunch of yeast to dry and sell to people to make bread. You know, they're basically using a very low sugar concentration. And if there's too much glucose in that, which they heavily aerate also because they want it to respire and not ferment, then, yeah, you can induce the Crabtree effect. But for brewing, yeah, you can add up to easily up to 25 to 30% corn sugar.
Yeah, that's good. Mine's 20. I usually stick at 20%.
Okay.
Some kind of sugar. I got away from rock candy just because I had a hard time melting it. But table sugar to me, you know, once it's gone, it's done its job. You know, I'm not so sure the yeast know the difference. I know one's harder to eat than the other.
Yeah. Well, not really. It's, you know, if you break it down to a molecular level, yeah, they're different in sizes, and the yeast is going to naturally take the easiest one in first, and then it's going to take the more complex ones later. But, you know, yeast is pretty hardy. It can take most of it in. Now, does it matter if you're using Belgian candy sugar? Not really. In fact, I consider Belgian candy sugar to be one of the big myths of Belgian brewing. Very few breweries actually use it. It's very expensive. Most of its, a good chunk of its weight is water because it's crystallized sucrose. And so you're paying for water when you buy it.
Oh, okay.
and because it has a higher water content, it's prone to having mold form on it, which nobody wants that happening because then you'll end up with moldy flavors in your beer. And it's also harder to handle and harder to store. So most breweries prefer to use a very simple form of glucose. And as far as I know, I think most breweries use what they call, well, basically corn sugar.
Okay.
Either liquid corn sugar or powdered corn sugar.
Okay. Yeah. All right. For us home brewers, we've been able to find this Belgian candy syrup. Actually, I've only tasted like one of them. I thought it was good, but I guess you're right. You know, in the end, it's all the same. It's a matter of time, but the yeast is going to eat it all. I guess I understand now whether it's hard to eat or easy to eat. In the end, it's going to be the same.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that will make a difference in reference to candy sugar is the color.
Okay, yes.
When you have colored candy sugars, the color is achieved by heating the sugar and caramelizing it to give it some color. And you know when you make, if you make any kind of caramel candy at home.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, there's a white-tailed deer walking through my yard right now.
I remember that. We had them in our backyard when I lived in Fly Creek next to Cooperstown.
Yeah, they're going to be eating my bushes.
Yep.
Anyway, when you caramelize sugar, you're taking something that has a very somewhat neutral sweetness to it. And when you caramelize it, often it has this huge explosion of flavor. So anything that has caramel in it has a very, very big flavor impact because caramelized sugars cannot be metabolized by yeast. So that caramel flavor ends up in your beer. So if you're shooting to add that caramel flavor from a dark or amber candy sugar, then it does make a difference.
But yeah, exactly.
If we're talking about, you know, white candy sugar versus table sugar versus corn sugar, it doesn't make a difference.
Okay, I can see that. So it's like crystal malts. It's the same as that philosophy behind crystal malts. The yeast can't digest it, and it winds up as sweetness in your beer, depending on what crystal malts you use or level of roast, I would assume. But we danced all around yeast now. I've heard that two or three times. I know you can't tell us what kind of yeast, but one thing I did want to know, you know, it's like Orval. Did I say that right? I better check first.
Yep, I'm
an Orval fan. I really am, but I know they use like 10 different yeast in their bottling, but I'm curious what y'all use. Do you have one proprietary yeast through all the beers that you use?
We use the same proprietary yeast for all of our beers, including in the bottle conditioning phase.
Right, I think I read that, but there again, the big WWW can get you sometimes as far as honesty.
Can't believe everything you read. the yeast that we use came from the University of Leuven in Belgium. They have a rather large yeast bank there that they have all kinds of different strains of yeast that they use for research because the yeast is easy to grow. It's a simple biological life form that can easily replicate. So a lot of scientists will use it for DNA studies. besides the run-of-the-mill research yeast, they also have, you know, a big bank of brewing yeast.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started in 1997, we went to the yeast bank and we said, we're looking for a brewing yeast that has these characteristics. What do you have? And they gave us a slant of, I think it was seriously, I think the code number was like B109 for their yeast bank. And, you know, what did we ask for? We asked for a yeast that could ferment a high-gravity wort. We wanted a yeast that had a lot of flavor impact. That is, it threw off a lot of esters when it fermented. It threw off a little bit of phenolics. And it could, you know, it could very well ferment a strong wort. That is, it had a good attenuation rate to it.
Yeah. Well, all you did there was just make me thirsty.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry.
Are you drinking any beer right now?
I've got one of my cream ales, so that's not a comparison whatsoever. So
Sadly, I don't have any Omegang beer in the house right now. I'm not sure what happened.
Well, that
very
is
unusual.
Yeah, that would be, I would imagine.
But I do have a beer from the Rodenbach Brewery in Belgium. It's their cherry beer, which they call Redbach, which is a very low gravity beer. I think it's only about 2.5%.
Oh, that sounds good too.
It's a type of beer that ladies love. It's, you know, obviously has a lot of fruit in it. It's very red.
Mm-hmm. But it has ruby notes.
Yeah, it's nice and sour, and I think it's a great beer. Mm-hmm. It's great, especially when it's 100 degrees outside, but right now it's only about 10 degrees outside.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Well, but another thing I wanted to touch on was water. You know, in my brewery out here in the garage, I call the Ale Nut Brewery, that me and my wife Moonbeam brew in almost every weekend. I'm big on water. And I start my water the night before, and I'm putting my phosphoric acid in there, getting a pH just perfect. Then I find out that y'all are using pretty much Coopertown well water. You have a couple wells on your property, and I'm just wondering if y'all adjust that. You take your water from the wells. Do you do anything else with it?
Well, we're actually located about 6 miles outside of Cooperstown. So we have our own well on site on our property, and most of the water in this area tends to be very hard and has a fair amount of calcium. But our water, it's a strange water. We tap down into the ground about 300 feet into bedrock, and the water has almost no calcium in it, but it has a lot of carbonates in it, and it has an unusually high pH for water. It's close to 9.
Oh,
which,
man,
is really, really unusual.
Yeah, that's unusual for even here next to the salt water where I live. Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of salt water, we also have about 80 parts per million of sodium in it. So it's a very unique water, and it's as far as the calcium content is concerned, I like it that it's low, because then we can add brewing salts like gypsum into the process and kind of fine-tune it to where we want it to be.
Do you adjust the pH at all? That's what I spend my time every night, the night before a brew day, is sitting there adjusting my pH to some preconceived idea that I had for a particular beer. I'll add phosphoric acid until it's like 0.01 or something like that away from my target. And I don't know if it's that important, but I try and do it. Is that something you're concerned with?
Well, for the water that we're using for the mash, we don't acidify it. Because once you add the malt in there, the pH kind of falls into place, especially if you're using dark malt. And so for a lighter colored beer like Hennepin, when we mash in, the pH might be like around 5.8. So we add gypsum to that. That helps bring it down. And we also supplement that with phosphoric acid. And we get it down to between 5.2 and 5.4.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go completely the other opposite direction. I know Omegang used to have, I guess, Duvel sister brew your beer. And then I learned, and this may not be true again, that y'all were actually purchased by who?
Well, the Duvel Morcat, which is the brewery in Belgium that makes Duvel. I'm biased, but I truly feel it's like one of the best beers in the world.
No, I agree. That's what I had last night. I wish I'd have saved it for this interview. I really do. But when it's in this house, it's fair game. So I bought a big bottle. Specs does carry that.
Good.
Yours is on the way. I wish I'd have saved it instead of this cream ale. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Please continue about that.
That's right. Well, I guess I need to tell a little bit of history about Brewery Omegang. The brewery started in 1997, and it was the brainchild of these two Americans, a couple from Cooperstown, who own a Belgian beer importing business called Van Bergen de Wolf. His name is Don Feinberg, and her name is Wendy Littlefield. Great people. They basically, with Van Bergen de Wolf, they were importing the cream of the crop of Belgian-style beers and bringing them into the U.S. And in the mid-90s, they thought, well, this is, you know, the craft brewing was really taking off, and they thought it'd be a great idea to start a craft brewery in the U.S. that specialized only in Belgian-style beer and tried to make it as authentic as possible. So they talked to the breweries in Belgium that they work with, the beers that they brought into the U.S., and they pitched the idea to them, and they thought it was a great idea to help promote Belgian beer and Belgian culture and essentially promote Belgian beer as a segment, you know, a legitimate segment of the beer industry. I hate using that word. I apologize. I hate calling it the beer industry because it sounds like a big factory. the breweries in Belgium that they talked to thought it was a great idea, so they invested in the whole project. And Duvel Morcat, which was one of those breweries, was the biggest investor since day one. And we started the brewery, and we were brewing for several years. And then in 2003, some of the other investors walked away from the business, and they wanted to cash in their chips, so to speak. And Duvel Morcat really loved what was going on, and they offered to buy the whole business out, and they took over in 2003. So in terms of, you know, a corporate takeover, it was like the best possible scenario. Working for the folks at Duvel, they came in, they basically said, you guys are doing a great job, don't change a thing, here's some money, go buy some equipment, start making more beer. And what I love about the folks at Duvel Morcat is that they're a fairly large brewery. You know, I guess if you want to compare them to something in the U.S., they're smaller than Sierra Nevada, but they're probably about the same size as New Belgium. But what really sets them apart is that they're really fanatical about quality, and they're just so serious about making good beer and doing everything scientifically and technically and artisanally possible to make their beer as good as it can be day in and day out. So, you know, having a sugar daddy like that is, it's a dream come true.
Well, you know, I read exactly that you were pretty excited that all took place. And, yeah. You know, there was, I read other things too, opposing views and stuff, but your opinion was that you really thought that was exciting news and kind of mm-hmm. taken it and ran with it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, over the last 2 years, we're trying to grow the brewery Omega Gang fairly quickly, and we're working on some expansion plans. But, you know, we're missing opportunities to sell our beer because we can't make enough of it. And they have spare capacity in Belgium at Duvel Morcat. So we thought, you know, we had considered having some of our beer contract made in the U.S. just so we could meet the demand. And we didn't really feel comfortable about it. We didn't really think that any of the breweries that did contract brewing could do justice to the type of beer that we make. And then we suddenly realized one day, it's like, well, why don't we go back to the mothership in Belgium and have them make some beer for us? Because they're going to know, you know, besides ourselves, they're the ones that will know best on how to make these types of beers. And so for the last year and a half, we've been having some of our beer produced in Belgium and brought into the U.S.
At Duvel?
Yeah.
I'm assuming, yep. Yeah. So, but there's still Duvel. Duvel is still there.
Oh yeah, correct? Yeah. I mean, that's their main beer.
Yeah, I didn't know if the recipes was kind of the same on the Oma Gang side, or I know you have a lot of beers, but I was just curious if Duvel was Duvel, and then when I go buy an Oma Gang, it's an Oma Gang, or if it's really the same. I'm sure it's different though. You have your own recipes brewed there.
We're really concerned when Duvel first started making the beer. You know, we want it to be identical to what we're making. And so, you know, the first batches that came over, we did a triangular sensory panel testing to see if people could pick up the difference, and people could not tell the difference between the beers. So they did a mm-hmm. great job, yeah.
So you have your beer. It just happens to be brewed somewhere down the road, or overseas.
And actually, that's good. Right now, there's still a little bit of beer left over at Duvel that they made for us, and
I'll take it.
Well, when I say a little, I'm talking about probably 10 to 20,000 cases worth of beer. Mm. And But yeah, they're going to stop producing that because they're running out of tank space too. And, you know, mm-hmm. we're well on our way to being able to stand on our own feet. So,
well, I thought y'all were humongous. You know, I thought y'all brewed how many barrels a year?
Oh, we're still pretty small. This last year we only produced, what was it? I want to say about 9,000 barrels. So even mm-hmm. in terms of microbreweries, we're still pretty small. But okay. In a few years, we're hoping that we can stay on track with this expansion. And if that's the case, you know, within 5 to 6 years, we hope to be up to around 50,000 barrels.
Yeah, I understood y'all are building a new facility, I guess, adjacent to the one you're in now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to be a green building with a grass roof and all that.
Well, the final design on it hasn't been approved by our project team, but yeah, we're hoping to incorporate a lot of environmentally friendly construction into it, and we've been toying mm-hmm. with having a green roof, which, you know, environmental-wise, it's not necessarily all it's cracked up to be, but mm-hmm. it certainly does make a statement to people that come and visit the brewery, as yeah. a nice visual statement.
All right. Well, I tell you what, that's a lot of great information. I had a couple, three more questions, and they're not for me. I told you on the phone I have some other podcasts out there. And, you know, if you want to make your brewers happy, I'm sure you have a whole staff. And what am I saying? I'm sure they're already smiling every day they walk in the room. But if you want to pump some of these podcasts in there and let it play all day from several of these folks I'm going to mention, they'll be smiling
okay.
too. So.
Okay.
But especially your show, this is great. But I have a good question from Mr. Rick and Dick of the Big Foamy Head. Or they sampled one of your beers on their show, and they had told me about it. But they had a good question about corking, and that, I didn't even think about that. You know, a bottling line's pretty automated, and man, mm-hmm. you can sling out bottles all day long on these bottling yeah. lines, but you cork. And I'm wondering, a very good question, how difficult is that, you know, compared to say a bottling line with caps?
Well, it's different in that you don't have a lot of comrades in the beer business that use that type of equipment. So when you do have problems with it, you don't have a lot of people to turn to help you out. And we, back in early 2006, we had a lot of problems with our corker. In fact, it broke down on us, and that was the big impetus for having Duvel produce a lot of beer for us. And it took us, you know, the cork machine that we have is, you know, it's a piece of crap. And when the pieces broke on it, we had a very hard time getting those pieces replaced because there's a small Italian company that didn't keep spare parts in stock, and they had to go make them from new. But, you know, as far as, like, the routine running of the line, it's a different piece of packaging equipment, so it has its own quirks and oddities to it, and but it's really not any more difficult than doing like a regular capped 12-ounce bottle.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. I didn't even think of that question. I'm glad they asked that. And then I told you about Mr. Craig and Jerry from the Brew Bubbas. They're another pretty good podcast. They interview a lot of – they just got off of Mr. Sam Calagione of Dogfish Head and Charlie Perpazian, which we create, as you know, is the godfather of homebrew at least.
Yeah.
But they had a question about a little bit about Brettanomyces, and I'm wondering if you use that in all your beers or a select few or if at all or if you're scared to turn it loose or
– Well, actually we don't use any Brettanomyces mm-hmm. in our production right now,
mm-hmm.
but we are producing a beer called Omageddon that we're going to release this summer.
Right.
And that beer we're actually going to use Brettanomyces in the bottle conditioning phase.
And just the conditioning part. That's kind of yeah. like Orval does.
Exactly,
I believe that's the only time they use Brett is in their yeah. bottling, along with apparently the other nine proprietary yeast, which we'll never figure that one out. But yeah, I've tried. That's one of my favorite beers trying to reproduce, but only because I haven't had a good Oma gang in quite a while. If I can get it more regular, it'd probably be the one I'm trying to emulate.
Yeah, I sure. love Orval. I went there a couple of years ago when I went to Belgium, and I just fell in love with the area and the brewery and the people down there. It's a fantastic place. My fantasy is to move to Europe and work at Orval.
Yeah, that would do me pretty good too. Yeah. So, And the last question I have is Mr. Johnny Max. He's a good friend of mine at brewcrazy.com. He's got a great podcast, too. And he thinks along the lines I do, as I got to alluded to earlier, about us homebrewers, and I'm sure you do, too, to some degree, pushing the limits. Uh-huh. And he's got a 21% all-grain beer he's been written up about in BYO magazine and several things. And basically his question's in line with my thinking. And what are you doing at Omegang to appease us homebrewers' appetites? We're always looking for something bigger and better. You know, and here I am speaking. I haven't even had a three philosopher, so I'm not the one that should ask this. But we're always pushing the limits, as you discussed.
You know, relatively speaking, I don't think us at Brewery Omegang are as adventurous as some other craft breweries. And, you know, I think we like to be a little restrained, and we do have a, you know, this obsession with trying to make very well-balanced beers. And a lot of these beers that are extreme in nature, you know, by definition, they don't have balance to them. They may be extraordinarily bitter. They may be extraordinarily hoppy in aroma. They may have, you know, very sour characteristics from Brettanomyces or lactic acid. And, you know, Omageddon is, I would consider that an extreme beer because we're using Brettanomyces and we're dry hopping it. And Three Philosophers I also consider extreme because it's a very strong beer and we're blending in a Creek Lambic into it, which is relatively unheard of. And, but, you know, it's all how you perceive things. In fact, you know, beeradvocate.com?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. They this weekend they're having their Extreme Beer Festival in Boston, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to go there on Saturday, and it's a hard festival to get into because everybody wants to be in that festival.
Yeah.
As far as brewers go, and you know, we've actually had people say to us, "Well, you don't really belong there because Three Philosophers really isn't extreme," mm-hmm. And I find that kind of an odd statement. But it, you know, it's all what people are getting used to.
Yeah,
you know, people make, you know, American brewers doing these extreme beers. It's pretty exciting. I don't find a whole lot of them very drinkable, but I do find them all very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like this whole kind of cultural experimental phase that craft brewing is going through, and I hope we can keep doing it because, you know, it's kind of like Americans taking the version of the pizza and making it into what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to end up with some really interesting, very good ideas being formulated by things that, you know, at first blush may not seem like a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that goes back to the Belgian mentality we discussed. You know, you find
exactly
something great, you stick with it, and that's what they've done. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't say you can care less if you don't like it, but that's kind of the mentality. We like our beer. If you don't like it, there's other beer, but this is our beer, you know? So that's kind of my philosophy too. And that's why I don't win a lot of awards. So,
yeah. And you know, that's just it's when you make an extreme beer, you make these wild and crazy beers, you're not going to sell a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it for the fun of it. You do it for a very select small audience that knows and appreciates that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, you're just kind of trying to keep that excitement alive in brewing. Not that you need to, because beer is exciting no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
but it's, you know, we do it for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, Randy, I know we've run, I don't know how many minutes. You think with all this gear, I'd have it down to a science, but we're going on at least 30 or 40 minutes here. So all I got to say is I so thank you for joining us, and I know it's kind of hard to align our schedules a little bit, and I'm glad I kept you up a little late there in that cold weather to talk about Omegang, but I really appreciate it, and I hope I can have you back on in again sometime
I'd love
soon.
To.
So, all right, well, thank you, sir.
All right, take care, Lonnie.
Okay, goodbye. Man, that was fun. That was extremely fun. That was my very first interview, actually, as y'all all probably well know by now, but finally got that cell phone hooked up. It's just a dilapidated mess of wires and all kinds of junk laying around just to get that cell phone signal onto this board. But I got it, I think. I think we can look forward to many more interviews, I hope. So, but this show is easily going to run up to an hour, and I really don't want to go over an hour of my gigantuous file size downloads as of right now anyway still. So I think I'm alone right now. I don't see Moonbeam anywhere. So I think I'm going to take us out with a song today for the end of this show. So Until then, brew on, brothers.
Well, we ain't gonna have any of that in this house. Lonnie's outside in the garage playing with his beer geek stuff, refractometer or hydrometer or whatever he's got out there. So I'm gonna take it over. First, I'd like to thank everybody that tried the Moonbeam Wieners. The recipe was on old Brew Crazy show. Johnny Max is a cool dude. Recipe's over 100 years old. And also, I would like to mention Barbecue Bob. All it takes is a bottle of ketchup and a beer to make the best barbecue sauce around. So we're going to try to wrap up this Belgian show with a little Jimi Hendrix that was rewritten and played by Lonnie Mack himself. I'll see y'all later.
Some kind of way out of here. Said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman that drank my wine. How man dig my earth? Unwell level on the line. Nobody over this world. To get excited, oh, the dip becomes exposed. There are many here among us. There are many here among us who I feel that life is but a joke. You and I, we've been through all that. This is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hours are getting late. Princess kept a view, and all the women that came and went, barefoot servants too. And outside in the cold distance, wildcat did growl. Two riders were approaching, and the wind began. And the wind began.